Afternoon, I'm going to open the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for February 10th, 2009. And I apologize, we have several sick people up here. Hopefully you can hear me through my froggy voice. We're going to open up a work session. We're actually going to start with Senate Bill 76. And Beth, if you can walk us through the amendments, please.
Yes. So 76-5 is, previously discussed 76-2 at our last hearing. It establishes a framework for dam removal on the Klamath River, subject to final analysis and confirmation. The difference that you're going to see in the 76-5 amendment is that the PUC must conduct a hearing under ORS 757.210. No later than 6 months after PacifiCorp files the final agreement. This statute requires the utility would have to bear the burden of showing that the proposed rate is fair, just, and reasonable.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, I've asked, excuse me, the Department of Justice. We have Paul Graham and Kurt Burkholder here somewhere to come and walk us through the amendments. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. For the record, just identify yourself, please.
For the record, I'm Paul Graham, Oregon Department of Justice, and on my right is Kirk Burkholder, Oregon Department of Justice.
Thank you. So whoever wants to start, Kurt, you want to walk us through the bill, or?
I'll defer to Paul on that.
Or the amendment,
section by
say.
Section, including
okay.
that technical amendment.
I just received the dash five, so I haven't had a chance to look at the dash fives. If the dash fives have nothing other than the technical amendment, I can explain that. That's in section four. The commission is supposed to be holding a hearing after the utility signs the final agreement along with the governors of Oregon and California and the federal government. Then the utility will submit the final agreement and some work papers showing its analysis as to why it believes that removing the dams rather than relicensing the dams will be a benefit to customers. Along with that information, it will also submit tariffs. And, you know, tariffs are things that the commission approves to set rates. They're like contracts between the utility and the customer that the commission has approved. And when tariffs are submitted, there's what we call a rate case. And a rate case is under 757.210, and that is the new statutory reference. So the commission will be conducting a rate case, albeit a limited one. It won't be a general rate case that looks at all the utilities, costs, and revenues. It will be a case that looks at whether or not the final agreement is beneficial to customers, that it's a good thing for customers to remove rather than relicense the dams. So that's the process that will be followed. Parties will be able to intervene in the process, and then the commission will make its decision as to whether or not it is best for customers to have the dams removed or relicensed. The commission will also put into rates the amount that of the $200 million that's the responsibility of Oregon customers for dam removal. So there'll be tariffs that are filed and adopted, and the commission then will authorize the collection of those amounts that are set out in the tariffs, regardless of what findings it makes on whether it's prudent or not prudent to remove the dams as opposed to relicense them. The commission's decision will then be subject to appeal, a direct appeal in the Oregon Supreme Court. And while the appeal is pending, the customers will continue to pay those surcharges. The idea is that the surcharges will continue to come in so that if the court eventually upholds a commission finding, say it's not a good thing to take out the dams, or it is a good thing to take out the dams, then the funds will be there. If it appears that the dams are going to come out, then the funds will be there for dam removal, and they'll continue to be collected through roughly 2020. And if it's determined that it's not a good thing to remove the dams, then the money would be available to PacifiCorp to invest in new screens and new ladders that would be used to relicense the dams. However, Pacific Corps would not be recovering that investment or getting a return on that investment in rates because that money would have come from customers. So the commission would make an adjustment in the investment base for Pacific Corps that we use for rates and would put a zero there for the money that's contributed by customers. So that's the nickel version of what's going to happen under subsection 4.
Okay. Could you, since we didn't get a chance to walk through the entire bill in the hearing, I was wondering if either of you could do that starting, obviously we don't have to go through all the whereases, but maybe starting with section 1. I don't know if you can do that or...
Well, we have the definition sections. Again, we're dealing with four dams, and the four dams are three in California, COPCO 1, COPCO 2, and Iron Gate, and then the J.C. Boyle Dam. And it also refers to a final agreement, and that's the agreement that I referred to earlier that Pacific Corps would hopefully sign with the governors of Oregon and California and the U.S. Department of Interior. Section 3 deals with one of the three pieces the commission will deal with in rate making, and this is called recovery of investment in the Klamath River dams. As Bob Jenks pointed out the other day in his testimony, this is something the commission does all the time. This is pretty much garden variety stuff to return the investment to a utility that it has made in a resource that serves customers. The difference here is that the commission will have to shorten the life of the resources. And normally a dam would have something like a 50-year life, and the investment would come back to the utility very, very slowly over 50 years. If we're going to take these dams out in 2020, then the commission will have to shorten the lives considerably, so there'll be that rate effect and that the remaining capital in the dams will come back fairly quickly. The amount of capital is not large. I believe it's probably about, the company would probably have better numbers, but I believe it's, I think the net book investment is about $100 million right now. And then there was some additional money spent for relicensing that the company would want to recover. So that's the first piece of this. That is Section 3. Section 4 is the surcharges for funding costs of removing the Klamath River dams. And this is the unique piece of this. This is something that is not business as usual for the Public Utility Commission. And this is a surcharge I talked about that would come in and be adopted in the Section 4 process. This money would be roughly $200 million, and Oregon would owe a share of the $200 million. It would be about $180 million. We arrive at the $180 million because we have an agreement that divides all of the costs and revenues for Pacific Corps in the six states in which it serves. It's called the MSP, or multi-state process. And under that agreement, the Oregon customers would be paying about 90% of this, and California customers about 10%. One of the reasons why is that California has a very small customer base. Pacific Corps serves only in Siskiyou County. I think there are only about 46,000 customers, whereas Oregon has several hundred thousand. California, however, this is not mentioned in the legislation, but under the agreement in principle and in the final agreement, there would be a provision that California would be responsible, in addition to its roughly $20 million share of the $200 million, for another $250 million, which would come from a bond issue. So there would be a total, if everything goes as planned, of about $450 million coming from Oregon and California. And Oregon's share would be 180, California's would be the remainder. The idea is that Oregon would be like a primary insurance carrier, and its liability would be capped at 180 under this bill. And that if the bill went above 450, then the parties would need to get back together. But one thing I do want to tell you is this bill authorizes the commission to flow through roughly $180 million through the surcharge. And if it's determined later on that the surcharge is higher, then as I read the bill, someone would have to go back and get more authority for the commission to increase the surcharge. In other words, the Legislative Assembly would have to be involved in any increase over and above the roughly $180 million responsibility that Oregon customers now bear.
So just to be clear, as far as financial liability to Oregon ratepayers, So this bill caps that liability at $180 million, is that correct?
With respect to dam removal. And then
and
you have the two other pieces, one of which I've already covered, and the one of which I've already covered is recovery of the investment. And as I said earlier, the investment's going to be recovered anyway. That's going to happen normally through rate making. It's just that the investment in these dams will be recovered on an accelerated basis.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hass.
thank you. On that note, then, what, if any, assurances are there that this bill would protect Oregon ratepayers from any additional liability should there be cost overruns? Is there anything, any assurance you can give us, either here or in writing?
I think this bill caps the liability at $180 million. I'm going to ask my colleague, Mr. Burkholder, if he has anything to add to that.
Chair, Senator, the bill doesn't address the scenario where the $450 might be exceeded in actual dam removal costs. That is the subject of the AIP. Agreement in principle, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
It's our intent to make sure that any final agreement that the state of Oregon would sign on to would include the same limitation. That is, customer contribution, Oregon's fair share of the $200, supplemented by the California bond monies, providing $450. And I'd also note, as you're probably already aware, that estimates to date, including by FERC staff, are under $90 million for removal of the four dams. But if the $450 should nonetheless, under some worst case, be exceeded, the bill, of course, imposes no state obligation. The proposed agreement imposes no state obligation. We would need to pin that down in final negotiations of the final agreement. What happens in the meantime, as contemplated by the AIP, are a couple reality checks on potential cost overruns. The first one being in 2012, when this U.S. determination under the agreement in principle takes place, based on further studies and development of a specific dam removal plan as opposed to estimates, you know, something that's more of a feasibility level and final specs, the United States will make a final call on relative risks, liabilities, and costs, and both states, California and Oregon, have the opportunity to review that at that time and either concur that dam removal should go forward or withdraw, including based on cost concerns, if our estimates to date are way off. So we have that opportunity, which should be enshrined in our final agreement, to take another look at the cost estimates and protect the state fisc.
Follow up.
When would that agreement be done? And if this bill doesn't address the scenario that was mentioned, should it?
The bill right now, Senator Chair, is specific in Section 4.3 in specifying that the rate payer surcharges shall not exceed the amounts necessary to fund Oregon's share of the $200 million, which might end up approximating $180 million, as Paul has mentioned. The schedule on the agreement is a target date of June 30th, 2009. To have something that might be executed by the governments and other parties.
Okay, I have a follow-up to Senator House's question. Could PacifiCorp come back to the PUC and ask for additional rate case above the $180 million under this legislation?
I think, as Paula has indicated, Chair, since the legislature is establishing in this bill that this will be the total ratepayer contribution and that it shall not exceed Oregon's fair share, I would have to say today that there's at least a strong argument interpretation that in order to ask for more in the future, the utility would have to come back to the legislature again.
I agree with that. Section 4 sub 3 states that the surcharges imposed under this section, and we're referring to the section that deals with dam removal costs, may not exceed the amounts necessary to fund Oregon's share of the customer contribution of $200 million identified in the agreement in principle. In addition, the total amount collected in a calendar year under both surcharges may not exceed more than 2% of Pacific Corps' annual revenue requirement, as determined in Pacific Corps' last case under ORS 757210, decided by the Commission before January 1, 2010. So what we have is really two caps. One, Mr. Burkholder and I have both alluded to the roughly $180 million cap. The Commission cannot exceed that unless the Legislative Assembly says okay. And then the other cap is the 2% of the revenue requirement. And the revenue requirement, for those of you who are not rate-making geeks, is the total amount of money that the utility will collect in its rates in a calendar year. So there can't be more than a 2% increase in that total revenue that the utility collects from its rates under this law.
Sure. May I follow up with one other point?
Mm-hmm.
Tag team fashion that's responsive to your question. I think the other important point here on that question is that in addition to the face of the bill and what it provides for or does not provide for, the AIP with Pacific Corp specifies that this is all that Pacific Corp will ask for. And again, subject to final negotiation, we intend that the final agreement, which will be binding, includes that same stipulation by Pacific Corp. But consistent with the AIP, that is their commitment to date, that this would be the total customer contribution.
So I will follow up, and then Senator Boquist, we'll get to your question. So let's just say hypothetically that the approval goes through, the Department of Interior picks a designated removal entity, the dam removal moves forward, and they find that there's some issues with sediment or something, and I might ask you or Mike Carey about that later, then who is responsible to pick up those costs? Is the state responsible, the taxpayers in general, the ratepayers, you're saying under this bill, are not? So in that scenario, is it the U.S. government is liable? I read through the agreement in principle, and it didn't name any of them as liable. So is the private contractor, the DRE?
I think either of those last two scenarios, Chair, could be outcomes of the final agreement in federal legislation. You're correct that the agreement in principle does not specify who would step in for cost overruns. I think continued negotiations of the final agreement will probably address more specifically what the federal government's role would be and ultimate responsibility regarding dam removal. But both in respect of those negotiations and staying true to what's on the face of the AIP, we haven't pinned that down yet.
But under this legislation, Oregon ratepayers would not be responsible.
Either way, SB 76 would impose no such liability, and I'm not aware today of any other statutory or common law theory for why the state would be responsible for cost overruns. Your other potential fix or scenario is also a possibility, and that is, if we end up having a federal agency contracting with a dam removal entity, engineering outfit, let's say, I'd be surprised, and I think we're going to expect through our final agreement provisions that such a contract also include provisions that provide for some cost overrun protections.
Okay. Senator Boquist, thanks for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on that. And Paul, I'd like to say it's good to see you, but we did this 2 years ago, two sessions ago, and it was the same thing. So,
Just as confusing.
Let me go back to a couple of things. First thing, as you're aware of, you made mention the dam removal element or entity might be responsible. And of course, I can't imagine any corporation being responsible for that. It would be written in the contract. But I think both you gentlemen are aware, page 9, paragraph 2, there are four people that say they're not liable for any cost overruns, period. Now, this bill caps Pacific Corp, as my understanding, Pacific Corp's customers, that's the ratepayers, and you correct me if I'm wrong, those customers are limited to $180 million unless the legislature were to change this in the future, which then leaves the United States, California, and Oregon, none of which accept any future liability. What is going to change between this date and January or June 30th in which we're going to convince somebody else to be liable for the cost overruns? And then you mentioned $90 million, the FERC estimate. Could you expand on that? Because that's a new number.
Okay. Senator Chair, answering your first question. What's going to change between now and then to pin that question down is a good question. It's subject to negotiation and frankly, new people with the new administration in Washington taking a look at that question. And I got to be honest, I'm reluctant to speculate further at this time in our capacity in advising the state agencies on how that might look in that final agreement or in the federal legislation, which would be part of implementing any final settlement. I'm sorry I don't have a better answer, but as of today, there is not a complete answer other than different scenarios that are subject to negotiation. Regarding your second question on the cost estimate for dam removal, that's derived from the FEIS, the Final Environmental Impact Statement, that FERC last prepared in the relicensing proceeding, where they are also evaluating alternatives, including dam removal. And FERC staff derived those estimates by looking at the numerous existing studies for the Klamath that take a look at the question, including some other estimates by engineering firms that have been retained by the state of California, which were actually lower estimates. FERC's came in a little higher at just under $79.7 million. I'm sorry, $88.7 million for their estimate. A lot of unknowns because the specs haven't been lined out. That is a general level analysis and cost estimate to date. Our approach in discussions for the AIP is to conservatively double that amount. And then our hope is that if you add the California bond amounts on top of that, that will be covered as a practical matter.
Senator Prezenski, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up, sure. Okay. So just to make sure I understand here, in negotiating this, you're saying that you believe the cost will be $90 million by FERC, and then to get to the 450, you just doubled that got us to 180, and then you just threw in $20 million more from California, and then we asked California to do $250 million in bonding. Am I following the logic here correctly?
Logic, the numbers, as I do, are a little off. 200 from ratepayers, 250 from California bond to provide 450 dedicated to dam removal.
You know, I just want to be clear. The $180 million is a cap. And if the dam removal costs less than that, then what happens to, does that money get refunded to the ratepayers? And that's how I read it in this bill. But
That's correct. It's up to the commission to decide what to do. It could be refunded to ratepayers or it could be otherwise used for their benefit, but it will be used for the benefit of ratepayers.
And that will be reviewed by the PUC.
That will be reviewed by the PUC. Well, one thing I wanted to say about the bill in general is that this bill does not deal with the entire set of negotiations. It does not deal with everything in the AIP. It does not deal with everything that's going to be in the final agreement. This is just the rate-making piece of this. And that's why if you look just at this bill, you're not going to see the whole deal. You're going to see basically what the instructions are to the PUC with respect to dam removal, return of investment, and recovery of power costs that may be incurred, if any, from the removal of the dams.
So if PacifiCorp decided, if they decided not to remove the dams, went through the FERC relicensing process and went through the normal PUC rate recovery process, is there any cap on ratepayer liability?
The ratepayer liability would still be capped at the 180 for dam removal. In other words, that's the full amount that's going to be collected. And then if the dams were not removed, as I mentioned earlier, that money would probably be applied to new investment to relicense the dams, such as fish ladders and fish screens, and the customers
so
would get credit
ready
and made the investment. Yeah.
Chair, if I might. I think also the chair was interested in if we weren't talking dam removal today and PacifiCorp had to come to the PUC, it's my understanding, not being a PUC lawyer, that there is no cap, but it's still subject to the standards of prudency and reasonable, fair, and just, or whatever your standard is. It also would be subject to the four-state, multi-state protocol that Paul described earlier as far as Oregon's share of those relicensing costs. But no otherwise statutory or prescribed cap on those costs.
And those costs could be more. We don't know.
FERC's estimates, again, drawn from the final EIS, with the ladders, screens, reduction in power due to minimum flow and ramping restrictions, and other conditions of a new license that would be mandatory pursuant to the Federal Power Act proceeding that's occurred to date is that the cost for relicensing would exceed $300 million.
Senator Prezonsky, did you have a follow-up?
I just need to make sure I understand it. And Paul, we pay, if I understand this correctly, the ratepayers pay the first $180 million of whatever, whether that's facilities, environmental, so on and so forth, and then there's a $20 million kick-in from California, and then there's $250 million in bonds. Is that that's step-stared, correct? Or is it, do we collect all the money to start with? Because if we only have a $90 million bill to start with, where's the rest of the money go, and what else can we spend it on, like environmental costs, and when does California really kick in?
Okay, we collect the $200 million, 180 roughly from Oregon and 20 roughly from California, from ratepayers, and that's done by the two state PUCs. And then the 250, as Mr. Burkholder has explained, and he's more familiar with this than I am because it's outside of the rate-making bailiwick that I'm involved in, would come from the bond issue from California.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Okay, so let's just say hypothetically the dam costs us $150 to remove, and it costs us another $30 million in environmental. Who's paying the first $150 and who's paying the $30? Ratepayers?
Chair and Senator, if I might. I think one clarification that might help answer your question is that the ratepayer surcharges are dedicated to dam removal cost only.
Mm-hmm.
That would include necessary preventive measures to make sure that before the dams are breached and sediments are released, that it's done in a way that would best minimize any downstream impacts. It would include permitting. It would include restoration, for example, of the reservoirs. So that you're not left with an ugly bathtub ring. But it would not include other undefined environmental expenses or liabilities. The Oregon ratepayers, through this bill, are only being expected to fund the physical removal and related measures for dam removal.
Question's not answered yet, Madam Chair. Dam costs $150 million to remove. Forget the $30 million in environmental damage. Who's going to pay the $150
million? Senator Chair, that would be funded by this account that's funded by the surcharges collected from both California and Oregon ratepayers per their respective share.
Okay, so my clarification, Mr. Chair, the question I understand is the $250 million in bond that California has committed wouldn't even be kicked in.
I guess the question is that committed for what exactly would the $250 million bonding from California be dedicated towards?
Chair, Senator, that also is intended to be used for dam removal costs. The cash flow and when the bond would be enacted and begin to put money into those accounts that are dedicated to dam removal costs has yet to be specified. So there's the possibility, but yet to be specified, that you will have two cash flow streams coming into the accounts, including California bond monies. But whenever those accounts are drawn upon, they are dedicated to dam removal costs. I'll also point out, pursuant to the proposed Senate Bill 76, that the PUC will have discretion in how those accounts are administered, pursuant to an agreement with the state of California, and trustee instructions or escrow instructions, if you will, as we go. So there will be opportunities built in through the PUCs to address adjustments as we go.
And we have the PUC here if there's additional questions for them, by the way.
No, sir, I understand the trustee.
Okay.
To get back to your hypothetical, by the way, you asked about $150 million mm-hmm. total dam removal costs. That would be divided pursuant to the Oregon-California agreement on the roughly 90-10 basis. So in that hypothetical,
okay.
Oregon customers would pay about $135 in California, about $15.
Senator Prezonsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So hearing everyone, it seems like everyone's really concerned is the liability and how much is on the hook for Oregon ratepayer as well as potentially the Oregon taxpayers. My understanding, Senate Bill 76 is going to kind of set the parameters, the framework of how we're going to move forward with the understanding that we're moving toward dam removal. It gives the directions that needs to be taken and the steps that, well, what we expect. I'm also assuming that there's nothing in 76 that's going to stop this legislature in 2010 or 2011 coming back and making changes if we see the sky's falling and the bottom's falling out and we see unattended liability and questions of whether we as taxpayers or the ratepayers of PacifiCorp are going to be somehow hooked for more cost. Is there anything that's going to stop us from doing that?
I think the answer is no. Again, I view this bill as instructions to the PUC as how the PUC is supposed to handle PacifiCorp ratepayers. I don't think this bill addresses taxpayer liability. I don't think there's anything that would allow you to come back and react to new information that may cause you to second-guess a decision you made with respect to this bill.
Yeah. So, Madam Chair, if I can follow up. So, basically, we're just saying, go forward, be cautious. Here's the parameters we have. This is what we don't want to see happen. And there's nothing to stop us as elected body to say, wait a second, it's gone further than what we've been told. We can have a second look at it, just like PacifiCorp can once they go through this procedure.
I believe that's a correct summary of what the bill says.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we interrupted you when you were walking through the bill. Did you have another question pertaining to that section? And then I'd like to have it finish
actually,
up.
Actually, yes.
Okay. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. I'm on page 6, section 10. We've talked about it quite a bit. Did I hear one of you say that FERC relicensure costs, not dam removal, would be close to $300 million?
Is that the estimate that you...
That's correct, Senator Chair. It would likely exceed that, and that's based both on the federal prescriptions to date and that relicensing proceeding. And the reason I say that would probably be a minimum is that if PacifiCorp were to go back to relicensing, it would also have to complete water quality certification proceedings in front of both California and Oregon DEQ, which would result in mandatory conditions that FERC is required to attach to its license. And those water quality conditions would most likely add to what's been identified to date as well as cost of relicensing.
So how would they recoup those costs without this bill for a traditional relicensure fee?
In traditional relicensing fee?
Uh-huh.
That would be part of the investment that would be added to the dams. One of our commissioners...
Who would pay for that?
The customers would pay for that if there are additional costs to relicense the dams. That would go into what we call the rate base, the investment base on which the company...
More than likely, rates would go up under a traditional rate case or a traditional relicensure for FERC.
Everything else being equal, rates would go up, but there are other things that may push rates down. One of the things that might push rates up would be additional investment in relicensed dams. The figure we mentioned before is about $300 million for screens and ladders. I don't know if that figure is correct, but assuming that figure is correct, then that money would be put into the investment base on which the utility earns a return. If the return is, say, $10 million, or 10% rather, then it would earn a return of 10% on the $300 million in the revenue requirement. So that one element, everything else being equal, would put rates up. There are other things involved in this bill that would reduce rates. One of the things is removing the dams would allow the utility to avoid making that investment, and that would, everything else being equal, reduce rates. Whether rates are going to go up or down as a whole, this is something the commission will be determining in the Section 4 process under the bill. They'll be looking at everything that might increase rates and everything that might decrease rates and making a call on overall whether this dam removal or relicensure is better for customers.
Okay. In the essence of time, is there any other sections of the bill that you want to finish walking us through?
I'll just go very quickly. Section 5, there are two trust accounts. There's one for the California dams and one for J.C. Boyle. The reason we have two different accounts is it's possible that J.C. Boyle may come out later. We may have more time to collect that surcharge. So we wanted to allow for some flexibility. And Section 6, recovery of other costs incurred by PacifiCorp. What we're talking about here for the most part is power costs. At the end of the day, what we'll have if the dams come out is a PacifiCorp that looks different from it does today. It will have these dams out as opposed to relicensed dams. And when the commission sets rates, it measures power costs. And this is basically instructions to the commission that when you set power costs, look at how the company has changed from dam removal. And then Section 7 has to do with the agreement to apportion costs and establish the trust funds. That's the Oregon-California agreement that we expect will arrive at this rough division of $180 million versus $20 million. We don't know that those are the exact amounts.
Okay. Okay, any other questions for these gentlemen before I call up a couple other people? Okay, thank you very much for being here today. Don't go too far away. Mr. Carrier, would you like to come up? I'm going to ask the governor's office to come up. I have a couple questions. Thank you, Mr. Carrier, for coming back. First of all, do you want to comment on any of the questions that have been made so far before I pepper you with some more questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Mike Carrier, Governor Kulongoski's Natural Resources Policy Director. I guess the only thing that I want to bring to the attention of the committee is on page 9 of the agreement principle. It clearly lays out the funding scenario for the two trust accounts that are established. And if you read through that section, it tells how those accounts are going to be funded from the ratepayer surcharge. It clarifies that there's no commitment of ratepayer monies beyond the $200 million, and assures that any amount over that, it's going to come from the California General Obligation Bond. So I think in answer to Senator Boquist's questions, there's a pretty clear scenario and a pretty clear commitment among the parties about how those accounts will be funded and how those funds will be used. And then at the end, there is a clarification as to any residual over the within the $200 million that's left over, that'll be refunded to the customers or to the benefit of the customers.
Before we go to Senator Boquist's question, I may be asking the same question as him, just scary. But so what happens if the bonds are not approved by the California voters?
Well, that is a great question. We contemplated that. Based upon the estimates that you heard from the previous two witnesses, we felt highly confident that the $200 million of the ratepayer surcharge is within the most recent estimate of the that was established within the FERC proceeding for removal. However, when we get to 2012 and the Secretary of the Interior's determination, one of the assessments the Secretary will make is an updated cost estimate. And at that time, if California has not yet passed its general obligation bond, that certainly would be a reason for Oregon to think twice about continuing forward in this agreement and this relationship without appropriate assurances from California that they're going to meet that financial obligation they've committed to.
Okay. Senator Boquist?
No, Mr. Carrier dug himself out of the hole, so I'm okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? I actually have a few more for Mr. Carrier, but I don't want to hog up this time. This isn't stated in the bill, but there has been some concerns or questions raised about sediment studies and as prior to dam removal. Can you talk about what testing, analysis, modeling is going to be done to look at the sediment that's been collected behind the dams, and what type of testing will be required before removal?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an issue of great importance, and it's an issue that we've addressed with a number of dam decommissioning removal projects around the Northwest. The most recent one was the Marmot Dam on the Sandy, in which they opted to release all the sediments as part of the dam removal, and have since documented that all the estimates they made in terms of the impacts on fish, water quality, and other ecological values were what was predicted and expected and within tolerance in terms of not causing harm. There have been a number of analyses done. The most recent one was put into the record last week by one of your witnesses about a study that was issued by the California Coastal Conservancy regarding the characterization and effects of release of sediments from these dams. There are really two dams behind which sediments have accumulated, the first one built and then the Boyle Dam. And certainly one of the things over the next 4 years that the Secretary of the Interior and the Bureau of Reclamation would be to commit to thorough studies which test those sediments, determine the volume, the physical character of those sediments, any potential for toxins or other bioaccumulatives that could be harmful to fish or the environment, and make a determination as what really is in those sediments and what the impact of releasing those sediments would be. So I'm not here to say today that we fully assessed what the impacts of that settlement would be. That is yet to be determined and is part of the Secretary's determination and would be part of each governor's concurrence that those tests and that analysis and those assessments are within reason to go ahead and remove the dams.
Okay. And then I had another question for you. Other concerns that have been raised, again, this is nothing directly related to this bill, but as far as precedent that this dam removal sets in the Klamath Basin for other parts of the Northwest, I wondered if the Governor's Office would like to comment on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for that question because it's a great question. Some have, by extension, said, well, this is just the first in a number of steps that lead to removal of the four lower Snake River dams, and I'm here to tell you that Governor Kulongoski certainly doesn't advocate for the removal of the four lower Snake River dams. His position on the Snake River dams has been what we call an aggressive non-breach approach to working with the federal agencies to adjust the operation and make physical modifications to those dams to make them as friendly as possible for fish. And I will say that throughout the Northwest, if you look at some of the agreements that have been made regarding dam removal, some of the dams that have been removed, whether it's the Marmot on the Sandy or the Elwha up in Washington on the Peninsula, and the cases where it's been chosen by the companies and government to remove these dams has been cases just like the Klamath where you've got very old infrastructure. As Mr. West testified, and it's a very compelling testimony at the end of your last hearing, you've got very, very old infrastructure here that's from 50 to 100 years old that is producing literally only 1% of the company's current power portfolio. There's no comparison between that infrastructure and the major operating dams on the Columbia and Snake River system that are producing many more megawatts and are regularly maintained and have much more life left in them.
Mr. Kerr, aren't those dams owned and managed by the federal government where these are privately owned dams?
Madam Chair, that is a difference, yes. The dams that are being removed typically are those that are owned by investor-owned utilities where the company, to ensure certainty and predictability for their shareholders, for their ratepayers going forward as to the costs that they may accrue by continuing to operate or not operate those dams, have been just a sound business decision, and that's how I would characterize this agreement as a sound business decision as well as a good public policy decision.
Any other questions, Mr. Carrier? Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you.
I want to see if there's anybody from the Citizens Utility Board here today. I'd like to ask them to come forward. Thanks. Mr. Bissonnette, can you state your name for the record, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. Bob Jenks, our executive director, testified in front of the committee at the last hearing, giving general support to the bill. He brought up a change that we had requested in terms of the statutory site under which the PUC's prudence review would be made. I have to admit I don't recall the last site, but it has been in Section 4, Sub 4, the site was ORS 756515, and that we did not think was an appropriate reference another proceeding, and we thought that 757210 was the proceeding under which the company should file its prudency review. And our only concern is that we have the tools to, if the company makes a filing, cuts a deal, we need the ability to review that deal and say, did the company act prudently or not? If the company did act prudently, then we can have that investment put into rates. If they did not act prudently, then those should not go into rates. And that's the question we'll be raising, and we think that the bill now referencing 757-210 gives us the ability to do that. So we're comfortable with seeing this bill go forward.
Okay, and do you want to comment on how you feel that this bill protects ratepayers in Oregon?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First, putting the statutory site of 757-210 means is that any agreement that the company signs onto is subject to the normal review for prudency by the Public Utility Commission. The initial version of the bill did not do that, and that was a significant issue we had with that. And so this, we feel, offers much more protection. Also, in terms of the overall issue of dam removal, not dam removal, what the prudency review will look at is what the cost for dam removal is versus what the cost for not removing the dams and going through relicensing, and which is the better investment on behalf of ratepayers, which investment ought to be put into rates. And so overall, being able to go into that prudency review and be able to look at the economic decision that the company made gives us, and we feel that this gives us the tools to do that kind of economic analysis within the PUC prudence review process, the one that's used for every investment decision that's made by a utility.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Citizens Utility Board? Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Beth, could you talk about the revenue and fiscal impacts, please? Because we didn't cover that opening in the bill.
So, like you remembered before you, you have a notice of no revenue impact on the Senate Bill 76-5 amendment, as well as fiscal analysis on the 76-5 amendments that say that the amended bill has this indeterminate minimal fiscal impact on the PUC.
Okay.
Those are before you, if you have any questions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, with that, I'll entertain a motion.
Work session.
We're still in work session.
Madam Chair, I move we adopt the -5 amendments dated February 9th.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves to adopt the -5 amendments dated February 9th, 2009. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't like this -5, and I like the -6 slightly better because it at least addresses the issue Washington and Wyoming getting away with paying nothing and actually puts a better cap on it. But since I'm not overly supportive of the 6 and the final end, I'm just not supportive of the 5 either. So.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Any other comments? Okay, so there's been no further discussion. Are there any objections? So noted that Senator Boquist is objection. With that, the amendment passes. Or I should say the amendment is adopted. -5, sorry.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 76 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 76 as amended to the floor with the -5 do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Senator Boquist, beat you to the draw.
Madam Chair, I still remain quite skeptical that we're not signing up for some severe liability here. And though we've sold this as a cap, it really isn't a cap because we can come back in 2 years and change this. I think it would have been wiser to wait 3 or 4 months until we see what the agreement in principle really looks like, because it states quite clearly, they all signed it, that nobody wants to assume liability. The one thing we are doing is establishing a framework for payments for a trust account and holding the ratepayers in Pacific Corp slightly harmless until such time we make another decision. So I'll be a no vote on the bill.
Thank you for your comments.
Thanks.
Senator, thank you.
First, a safety check, and then secondly, a comment. First safety check would be a potential notice of a potential conflict of interest. My company consults in the area of renewable energy and utilities. PacifiCorp is a client of my company in 07 and 08. And then secondly, I'm a fourth-generation landowner on the river. That given taken care of. Never before have I ever been able to vote on a bill that routinely makes all my friends unhappy. As we heard this bill for the first time, I drew a map of the river for the good senator to my left. And as everyone came up to testify, I pointed out not where they were from, but exactly where they lived, because I know, minus the lobbyists, I know every person who's testified from both sides of the state, from both sides for and against. And it's a miserable place to be. But I think short-term, this is a bad bill. Long-term, I think we're actually protecting people.
Any other comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Prasansky.
I'm comfortable and satisfied with what we've heard and what's on the record as to taking the steps that we can take at this stage and this time regarding setting a cap for the liability for the ratepayers, as well as not falling back on the taxpayers at some time in the future. And the reality, I'm not sure Senator Boquist's statement as to coming back and changing in 2 years as to how we would say, well, we're going to go in for more obligation. At this point, I feel that's just a check and balance. So if for some reason California can't produce their part of the bargain, FERC goes through their process and determines for whatever reason it's going to be much greater cost, and whoever's going to be the dam removal entity or the federal government's not on the hook, we can always come back and say we're out. We, in good faith, are going forward to set the framework and allow it to go to the next step. And I respect that we may know something in 2 or 3 months as to where the agreement reaches, but at the same time, I feel that there's enough safeguards for us to step back if we need to, even this session, if the reality of something goes wrong in 3 or 4 months.
Okay. Thank you for this comment. Any other comments? Appreciate all the hard work of the committee. Obviously, spent a lot of time looking at this, and certainly I, as many of you, have had questions that I feel have been answered here today, and I'm glad that we put many of those answers on the record. Certainly, this is one step in a many-step process. We'll be working very closely with the governor's office, but I do want to say that for many of the Oregonians and Californians who have worked on this over the years, I've been familiar and worked on this issue 15 years with the Klamath, and I have to say that when somebody told me there was agreement, I was shocked. And so I think that it's a step forward if we can get people in the basin that agree on how to move forward. I think that's a positive thing. Obviously, there's a lot of steps still in the process that has to happen, and we'll be working closely with the governor's office and Department of Interior to make sure that all of those issues are addressed. I also appreciate the work of the Department of Justice and that you are here today to answer our questions, and we will be asking you to follow up with some of those in writing, so appreciate that. Okay, we have a motion on the floor to move Senate Bill 76 as amended with the dash fives. No further discussion. So with that, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Lopez?
No.
Senator Pisanski?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, motion passes, and I will carry the bill to the floor. Okay, with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 76, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 193. This is our water day, colleagues, so I just wanted to make sure you knew the concurrent theme here.
That's why it's raining.
That's why it's raining. We like rain. It's a good thing.
You notice everybody's leaving, Madam Chair.
I notice. Okay, so first up, actually, Beth, could you please give us a brief overview?
Senate Bill 193 directs the Water Resource Department to develop an integrated state water resources strategy, requires that the Water Resource Department consult with DEQ to develop data on an ongoing basis that would include in-stream, underground, human consumption, and water supply needs.
Okay. Thank you, and I appreciate your patience. First up, I'd like to, we have some directors of agencies. Phil Ward, the Director of the Water Resources Department, Dick Peterson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and Jane Bacchieri from the Governor's Office. Thank you all for being here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Why don't you start, Mr. Ward?
With your permission, Madam Chair, may we have the Governor's Office start?
Certainly. if she agrees, it's fine.
That's fine. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jane Bacchieri. I'm a natural resources policy advisor for Governor Kulongoski. I'd like to thank you today for the opportunity to talk about Senate Bill 193 and the governor's legislative agenda around water. Oregon's waters are an integral part of a healthy state economy and one of the foundations of its quality of life. Statewide, the demand for water continues for a wide variety of beneficial uses, including irrigation, municipal and industrial needs, and for fisheries, aquatic health, recreation, and aesthetics. Oregonians are guided by the need to protect the unique environmental resources of the state, and we need to manage our waters in a way that recognizes the importance and validity of all these uses. However, water resources management in Oregon is facing a number of significant challenges. Surface water is nearly fully allocated during the summer months, and groundwater is showing declines in both quantity and quality in many areas. More than 1,100 water bodies are impaired for at least one pollutant. 24 species of fish have been identified as threatened or endangered under the Federal Endangered Species Act, while another 31 are listed as state-sensitive species. These challenges are heightened by two pressures, climate change and population growth. Climate change will greatly influence how we collect, store, and use water in Oregon. Rapid population growth will radically affect demand for water. Climate change and population growth are bringing a new sense of urgency to water resources management in Oregon. Governor Kulongoski is committed to addressing these water challenges and ensuring sustainable water resources for Oregon's future. Over the past year, the governor worked with state agencies and key stakeholders to develop a proposal for a long-term statewide water strategy for consideration by the 2009 legislature. The product of these efforts is the Headwaters to Ocean Initiative, also known as H2O, which identifies priorities and strategies for addressing water issues in Oregon. With the current budget challenges we are facing, the governor's recommended budget for the next biennium does not fund all the recommended actions in the H2O initiative, but is prudently focused on some of the most important recommendations and provides an essential step forward for addressing critical water issues and current and future water needs in Oregon. Senate Bill 193 is the cornerstone of these recommendations. Senate Bill 193 will provide the resources necessary for the state to engage in a process to develop an integrated water resources strategy for Oregon. This comprehensive strategy is not intended to focus on water supply issues alone. The governor believes that any strategy must also address water quality issues, must ensure that the ecological and social benefits of clean, abundant water are achieved, must achieve the smart use of water through conservation, efficiency, and reuse, and should be guided by information from continued monitoring and research. Senate Bill 193 will put Oregon on a path to managing our water resources in a way that will protect current and future beneficial uses, be responsive to changing conditions, and ensure sustainable water supplies and water quality to benefit Oregon's people, communities, environment, and economy. In addition to a copy of my testimony, I provided the committee with a one-pager on the water pieces that are included in the governor's recommended budget to provide some context. And I'd like to thank you today for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Go ahead, Phil. And I'm going to ask folks, because we have a lot of people who want to testify. I know you guys aren't going to read your testimony, so I don't even have to ask you.
We won't do that, Madam Chair. Phil Ward, for the record, Director of the Water Resources Department. Madam Chair, we'll get this thing going here right now. We're set to go. So go ahead, Jane. Give us the next one.
Okay.
So a brief outline of what we want to talk about briefly with you today, what we view as a strategy, why do it now, what's the foundation we've put in place, what we need in terms of resources from you all, and then a bit, quick summary.
So if I might, Chair Ding, we're going to just tag team here a little bit. And for the record, my name is Dick Peterson. I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And I'm certainly glad to be here to offer some insight into 193, some testimony on that. This is a great opportunity for us. And Chair Dingfeller, I want to acknowledge your leadership in the work that you did going around the state and working with roundtables to not only reinforce but certainly acknowledge that from citizens the importance of water resource, probably the most defining resource that we have in Oregon with over 100,000 miles of streams and rivers, 360 miles of coastline, it is a very important resource. And one thing I want to certainly say right up front what this bill isn't about, the Water Resources Department and other state agencies and DEQ have a strong working relationship. We work together well. This bill isn't about telling us to go off and work together. It's about looking forward with a strategy that integrates work from surface water, groundwater, from ocean to headwaters.
Great. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, you can see, back up one for me, would you, Jane, quickly. And what I'd note here is that what this bill attempts to do is build on some existing authorities that reside in the Oregon Water Resources Department body of law. So there's existing direction to the department to do this kind of thing, but this bill enlarges upon that, okay? And so what do we mean by creating a strategy? And what this slide shows is two of the traditional models that have been used around the West to develop these kind of strategies. The traditional long-term planning process, very data-intensive. The strategic planning process, less data-intensive, a little more flexible. What we are proposing here will be a hybrid of the two, where we build on a data-based foundation, but with some of the flexibility in more found in the traditional strategic planning process. So why do this now? Some years ago, we had an intern in our offices, Madam Chair and members, and we asked her to do a survey of the western states in terms of how many of those states that carry the same body of law relative to water that we do here in Oregon have a long-term supply strategy for their water resources. How are they going to meet their long-term water supply needs? She determined that there were two states in the West that did not, and the rest did. And those two states that did not were Alaska and Oregon.
So one of our responsibilities in the state is we're delegated the responsibility to ensure we're in compliance with the Clean Water Act. And foundation to that is that we, DEQ, have the responsibility to ensure that all beneficial uses that water is for are protected. And that's a foundation in our responsibility. It's certain that the amount of water available in streams affect the quality of water in streams, and so integrating our look forward in that to that we can ensure that all beneficial uses are protected from aquatic resources and fishing to drinking to agricultural uses. One thing that we know is that our water bodies in the state have some challenges. There's about 14,000 stream miles that do not meet water quality standards around the state. And our responsibility under that is when that occurs, we have to develop what we call clean water action plans. The technical term for that is total maximum daily loads, where we look at methodologies to improve water quality so that we can serve those beneficial uses. And I will say we're making some great progress in writing those clean water action plans, and they're pretty comprehensive. They work across both point source and non-point source and capture the community in the area to start working forward in improving water quality in the state. And I might also acknowledge here there's a groundwater component of this. We're talking about water and water and groundwater. About 70% of all Oregonians rely on the state's groundwater for drinking, and it's something that we need to continue to pay attention to and work together to ensure that water is available for a number of years.
90%?
Pardon?
90%.
90%.
So it's amazing in a state like Oregon. I think you all have seen these two slides perhaps before, but water resources are limited in our state today. And the slide on the left shows where water is available for future appropriation surface water during the month of August in Oregon. And you can see that's practically nowhere. Basically in the Willamette Basin, there's some water still available, surface water, for appropriation. The slide on the right identifies our groundwater management areas in the state where groundwater is in tough shape, and those areas are growing. And certainly, these two slides, the bottom slide is not a Where's Waldo exercise, but just an indication that Oregon is projected to grow by about 1 million people by 2030. And the left slide articulates the potential impact of climate change on our water resource, in that it is projected that the mid-elevation snowpack that we rely upon to a great extent for late-season surface water here in this state may well be significantly impacted through climate change. So we have tried to build, in the last several years, some foundation for this exercise based on data. And the left side there are some things that we've done at the Department of Water Resources. I'll just tick through them really quickly. We have done an analysis statewide of where water is available and where it's not for future appropriation. You saw one map of that regard. Essentially, what that analysis says today is that surface water is available in the winter today, not in the summer. Obviously, we know where the water rights exist in our state, and we have an extensive stream gauging network that has record back for many decades that helps us manage the water resource. We're building a comprehensive groundwater data network, and we recently completed a water demand forecast that forecasts Oregon's water needs for the years ahead. Along with that work, we've recently done an inventory of conservation opportunities. Where can we gain new supply through conservation? An inventory of potential storage sites, both above and below ground. And we've partnered with the university systems in Oregon and Washington to do some preliminary climate change work.
So carrying over to the right side of the screen there, I'll start out by saying the foundation of any good decision-making in terms of water or any other resources is good information and data, and we take that very seriously, and that needs to be part of an informed decision-making on moving forward with water. DQ certainly has a network of water monitoring that we inform things like the list of impaired water bodies. We have ambient monitoring stations around the state. We capture monitoring from watershed councils around the state. We do a network of toxics monitoring, and so the value of having that informed decision is critical in looking forward with this strategy.
Both these agencies, and I think DEQ has a much more mature history in this regard than Water Resources does, but both these agencies have invested in working with local communities relative to this type of work in recent years. In 2007, this legislature provided some limited funds for us to work with local communities on water supply planning. We've done that. And then in the 2008 supplemental session, you all provided $2.5 million to provide some, or excuse me, $1.75 million to provide some feasibility grants for water conservation, reuse, and storage work.
One of our biggest things we try to do is provide money. 319 refers to money that comes from EPA that we pass to, usually partner with watershed councils and OEB grants to do watershed improvements. And we have a state revolving loan that comes from the federal government that we're making accessible not only to communities but also to non-point source improvements. So there's loan money out there that we make available to communities and others that want to improve watershed health.
Additionally, our departments recently completed 2 days meetings with the stakeholder community. Representatives of the Water Resources Commission were involved with this, as was the governor's office. We interviewed 41 different organizations relative to this activity, got some really good input. That really supplemented the information that Mr. Peterson referenced earlier relative to the water roundtables that Senator Dingfelder was involved with this last year. So here's what the governor's office or the governor's budget has articulated as resources to be used in this effort through the next biennium. It establishes two positions at the Water Resources Department. One, a point for the science work that we will continue to do in this effort, and then a public policy person to assist with the actual crafting of the plan and putting together the process.
And DQ's piece of that is that we combine the scientific and policy specialist into one person.
So, Madam Chair, members, this rather unwieldy-looking bicycle here is kind of our vision for how this might work. Obviously, the agency piece of this that you see in the top left-hand corner is much broader than the two agencies seated at the table. The reason you see these two agencies in the lead is because they are the primary regulatory agencies related to water here in Oregon. But we see definitely a broader group of state agencies that encompass the full range of natural resource agencies that have an interest in Oregon's water resources as a part of the agency advisory piece. And you see the other policy and technical groups. Again, this could change, but this is how we're envisioning these things at this time. And then the project team staffed by DEQ and WRD. And I just would note here that this represents a different concept than we've seen in most of the other Western states. Most of their long-term plans focus on the supply piece. Only California, as we've been able to ascertain it, really incorporates the water quality piece into that equation in a clearly articulated manner. So in summary, Madam Chair, again, this is a partnership between WRD and DEQ in close coordination with the other natural resource agencies. We visualize extensive participation from stakeholders to address the full range of water resource issues that our state is facing, and basing what we do on sound science and data. Again, we're required to develop an integrated strategy, and then the bill anticipates that this strategy would not go into force until it was ratified by both the Water Resources Commission and the Environmental Quality Commission.
Okay, questions? We'll start on the left this time, Senator Haas.
Thank you. I think it's great to have a strategy, and I applaud this effort. And so these questions take is just kind of as devil's advocate kind of questions. But first, I don't see any real teeth here, and for practical purposes, How do you force some of these? So the strategy is you want to, it should be an agricultural strategy or economic development. And then what happens when you have a new administration come in and that administration has different priorities? How would that work in real life?
I'll take a cut of that, Dick, and then you can follow with me, Madam Chair, Senator. I think the safety valve there, Senator, would be the articulated strategy ultimately being adopted in rule, or at least appropriate portions of it, by the two commissions. And so that then ultimately that strategy would live beyond Dick and myself. And ultimately as well, we're required under this bill to, with some reporting dates back to the legislature, I would assume there would be significant oversight by this body as well over time.
Yep.
Well, just to follow up, I would like to think that the governor, whoever that will be, has a strategy here, whether it's ag or economic development. And so I just, it's like if we don't pass this, it's not like we don't, wouldn't have a water strategy. And in fact, I think the statute that's there is somewhat of a compass or some principles based on, in the public welfare that we have a coordinated, integrated state water resources. So I just wonder how much this brings to the party, is all.
Do you want to comment?
Maybe I'll start, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas. The way I look at it is that to really ensure in terms of looking forward by a rich public process, in terms of looking at an integrated strategy, that we're paying attention to everything comprehensively, groundwater, surface water, integrating our water quality and water quantity direction in a way that serves Oregonians and beneficial uses, so that we, as agencies and rulemaking entities aren't disadvantaging the need to move forward with providing that beneficial use. So I just think it's a more of a comprehensive look and a forward look in terms of how we're going to approach water.
Thanks.
Senator Boquist. Thank
you, Madam Chair. I concur with Senator Haas. I mean, we need a water strategy, and we've been doing some, and we need a better strategy in the future. There's no two ways about that. And for the record, Dick, you can pass on this question because you've already in testimony elsewhere. And so, Phil, I'm not beating you up here. And so the governor's staff needs to recognize that I'm just not ambushing you. The governor's budget almost in every cycle comes in here, in the three cycles I've been, is dead on arrival, and the legislature looks at it. Unfortunately, given the present situation of the economy, President Obama said the obvious last night. We're in a depression of the size of the Great Depression. The cost to implement this particular strategy to improve water quality, which we need to do and identify it, is $490,000. The water department is facing a 20% cut, frankly, today, most likely, as one option. That doesn't include this $490,000. I mean, I guess my question is what could we cut in the department, or what would you do if you were told implement this when you're facing a 20% cut? You're not going to get the $490,000. What goes by the wayside? What do we do? And again, Dick got the answer this last time. So, and you may not have an answer other than we look at it as we go along, but I think it's a realistic question.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think that's a fair question. And it certainly should this agency face a 20% reduction in our budget and not have any resources to be able to dedicate this, it's going to make implementation very difficult.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have a lot of people who want to testify on this, so I'd like to hear from them. I appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll have some other questions for you all, but thank you for your hard work. I will say just one comment on this for the agency's sake, because I've been working on this for many years, is that it is unfortunate timing as far as the budget. However, there's been a lot of work that's been put into this. As you've seen, all the different data that's currently being collected, and there isn't sort of a plan in place to integrate that currently. So part of this is, you know, my question is, can some of this be done without, you know, new FTE, considering that much of this information has already been gathered, and we're talking about a better coordination integration among agencies that should be happening already. So some of this isn't new, some of it is, and I'd like you to think about that as we continue to work on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to go to the three-minute rule because we don't have a lot of time. We want to try to get through both 193 and 94 because many of the same people are testifying. I know they came from other places to be here today specifically for this. So I'm going to call people from away. Let's see, do we have anybody? I do know that Dennis Darity from Umatilla drove far. Dennis here? Yeah, come on up, Dennis. Ken Vance? Ken here? Can you come up? I'm going to call people that I know came from far away or out of the Capitol first, so we make sure and get to hear them. And Lorna Stickle. Welcome, Dennis. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Storty. I'm a Umatilla County Commissioner, starting my 13th year, and currently chair of the Association of Oregon Counties Water Policy Committee. The Water Policy Committee and the Legislative Committee of the Association accept the need for this bill and recognize the values to be attained from it. We support it. In concept, we are not yet familiarized with all of the implications and details, but we want you to know that we support it, and we applaud the efforts that have been built into this from the governor's office down through the agencies. Our interest, I'm sure, is going to cause us to leap into that middle basket, at least on Phil Ward's bicycle, and we do want to participate in the development of the strategic plan. We're hoping that the effort leads to an outcome that will encompass all of the needed components, from visioning and planning to include then management, regulation, and even enforcement. We think the time is here to develop a policy, and the fact that we're one of the two Western states that don't have a policy, I think, suggests why this bill is important. If current legislation were adequate, we probably would have a plan now. So regardless of the times and the other challenges, it is the right time to get started on this. So I'll sit here and answer any questions if you have any later, but that's our message.
Thank you. You go ahead and state your name for the record, please. Lorna, why don't you come up, because you're up next, please.
My name is Ken Vance Borland of Corvallis, and I represent the Society for Conservation Biology's Freshwater Working Group. Madam Chair, committee members, the Society for Conservation Biology's Freshwater Working Group believes the proposal to develop an integrated state water resources strategy is a positive step towards successful long-term management of Oregon's waters. One element that seems to be missing from the bill is the use of the best available science as a basis for the strategy, although I was pleased to hear the directors state the value of science in this process. Our organizational values as the Freshwater Working Group include that science should inform policy and management decisions that affect freshwater biodiversity and water security. An example of the application of the best available science within the policy development process is given in this attached paper by Rue and others titled Improving Cross-Sector Policy Integration and Cooperation in Support of Freshwater Conservation, which described a process that occurred within the government of South Africa. A great deal of scientific research on Oregon's waters and aquatic ecosystems exists, as is illustrated by the attached six-page list of references that was assembled in a few hours using Google Scholar's searches for Oregon water and Oregon aquatic ecosystems. Thus, we believe that the introduction to SB 193 should include the statement, whereas a large body of scientific research on Oregon's waters and aquatic ecosystems exists. Further, we believe that SB 193 Section 1, Subsection 3.A should be amended to include that the strategy be based on the best available science, and that Section 1, Subsection 3B should be amended to include that scientists should be consulted during the development of strategies. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for these suggestions. And why don't you go learn, and then we'll see if there's questions for any of the panel.
Did she pass out my stuff?
I think she's coming.
Oh, she's coming. Okay. Well, thanks for letting me talk to you for a few secs. I'm Lorna Stickle, and I work for the Portland Water Bureau as a water resources planning manager, and I'm also the project director for the Regional Water Providers Consortium, which is 24 different water providers in the Portland area. I was a member of the Water Resources Commission for 11 years, and I was chair for four. And I've practiced land use and water planning in Oregon for 35 years. I know, I don't look it, but it's true. So you have a letter from the Portland Water Bureau supporting this bill overall. And then I have a little list there about why a lot of these things are important, and some of them have already been mentioned. But it's a logical next step in the what was called the OWSCE process, the Water Supply and Conservation Initiative, which was funded in the last session. I think it's a pretty well-crafted bill. It doesn't need to be super specific. And I think the couple things, I guess, that I can say that are perhaps a little bit different is that spent quite a bit of time with the Water Resources Department over 11 years, traveling around the state, working with the different stakeholders. The body of law that exists now for water is huge in the state. I mean, it's inches thick. And although there are those policy statements in 536, it is not a coordinated integrated strategy, and that is really what I think this is all about. This is not about doing tons more data or research. It's about collating and coordinating so that we can meet the challenges that we know are coming, and those were already mentioned, growth and climate change and the condition of the water resources as it sits today. And we really do need to look at this in a strategic kind of way. So although I don't totally agree with everything that Water Resources has said is in this hybrid approach in general, the strategic approach is definitely the way to move. And so the one last new thing that I think I can say is that while you this does appear to be attached to a resources consideration, knowing the likelihood of whether any new resources can be applied to this or how you would readjust within the department is not an excuse for proceeding, at least proceeding into this area. If it takes a little bit longer, so be it. It takes a little bit longer. But these issues of growth and climate change are not going to wait for us. And I would like to suggest one other thinking outside the box about the resource side of things. It's not necessarily so much what can Water Resources cut in order to do this. It's how might you might bring resources to this question that are not traditionally thought of as resources. And one of the suggestions would be there are intergovernmental agreements that have been written with federal or local agencies in the past to bring staff to bear on a very specific subject over a specific time period. These things can be done, and I believe there are agencies who would be willing to step up for this to be considered. So I think that's it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Lorna. I appreciate it. And given your perspective of many, many years working on this issue, and appreciate the out-of-the-box thinking, because I think we need to look at that. Any questions? Senator Brzozinski.
More of a comment, I guess a statement, and maybe a response from Mr. Van Morlen. You stated when I walked back in that you wanted to make sure that scientists consulted. I expect that the agencies are going to be using their own scientists, but are you basically saying you don't think they should be in a silo working within just the departments, but instead should be reaching out to others within the field?
Senator and Madam Chair, yes, that is the case. I believe that this concept of best available science include the available part is research that's already there, doesn't need to be funded to go forth. But the best part also includes peer review of scientific research that's published in the literature. And no doubt the agency scientists do excellent work, but there are other perspectives.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for coming here and testifying today and sharing your thoughts. Appreciate it. Janet Newman. You know, Janet came here specifically for this. And I'll also call up Joe Wentworth and David Piltz. Welcome. Janet, good to see you. Why don't you go ahead and get started?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have written comments that have been distributed, I hope, so I will try to make my oral comments very brief. For the record, I'm Janet Newman. I'm a professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School, where I teach water law, among other things. And I'm currently on a year-long sabbatical working as on and off council basis with the Tonkin Torp Law Firm doing water issues and water policy. I'm not here representing any client or the law school or Lewis and Clark College. I'm here just to give an academic and policy, not an academic ivory tower perspective, but an academic and policy perspective. I'm about to publish a treatise on Oregon water law that I've been working on for way too long a time. I've also served on the Western Water Policy Review Advisory Commission appointed by President Clinton several years ago, where we took a look at federalism issues in water management, and I was the first president of the Oregon Water Trust for many years in working through the in-stream water rights law. And way long time ago, I was the director of the division, now Department of State Lands. I'm here to support Senate Bill 193, and I'll say very briefly why what I think is particularly important in the bill and how that's different from current law. We are behind the curve. You've heard that from the water resource comments at the very beginning. We're one of only two states that doesn't have a state water plan. We need to get caught up on gathering solid data. I appreciate the comments from Mr. Vance to that effect as well. We need to get caught up on estimating future needs and developing strategies to meet those needs in a sustainable way, and all of these are addressed to some degree in Senate Bill 193. Here's what I think is particularly important, the integration of water quantity and water quality. It's absolutely logical and inherent in the natural world. It's not in the current law. Excuse me, the bifurcation in current law is a matter of history because water allocation, water was property to be divided up long before it was pollution to be cleaned up. And so we have a serious bifurcation in the law, pulling those two agencies together to form the basis of this planning process is very, very important. DEQ isn't the only other agency or participant called out in the bill, and I want to take this a little bit further than the agency folks did. On the chart, the bicycle chart did not include tribal governments, and that is called out in the bill. I think it's very important that the consultation with the tribes be maintained and implemented. And the bill also says that the ultimate strategy needs to lay out specific functions and roles for a whole list of other state agencies and entities. And I think that's critical, too. The approach is essentially an integrated plan but distributed implementation. I think that's a key to its success. And couple more quick comments. We do need to get on the ball with ongoing data gathering, and that's in the bill. The other thing that I think is very important is that the proposal expands the inventory and the responsive strategies beyond traditional water supply, and it uses the word needs as opposed to demands, and I think that's really critical as well. And it focuses on climate change and ecosystem services, and those are two areas where we absolutely have to be both adaptive and prepared and flexible in how we meet our future water needs, which may be different than our current water demands. And then finally, I don't think anyone has specifically mentioned yet that the bill does allow for the possibility of identifying a long-term dedicated funding source. Now, obviously, that's not necessarily going to happen right away, but I do think it's critical, even in these economic times, that we go ahead. Because as Lorna Stickle said, we have a plan. It's not coordinated and it's not cohesive, but we are functioning to implement water laws as we speak, and it can only be better if we try to take some of the direction of Senate Bill 193, and therefore we need to figure out creative ways to fund it. And I appreciate the leadership of the chair and this committee in seeing that this gets done.
Thank you very much, Janet. Appreciate your comments. Joe.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Whitworth. I'm the director of Oregon Trout, and we recently merged with the Oregon Water Trust. So we have an interest not only in fish populations, but also irrigators that are doing work on their land and this resource in particular. We are 2 weeks away from the 100th anniversary of the water code in this state. it is currently... I recognize these are difficult times. There's really no easy time to do this, but I think that we're in a place where we really do need to do this. I co-chair the Water Subcommittee of the Oregon Global Warming Commission's Natural Resource Committee with Phil Ward, and a number of these things, including developing an integrated water resource management plan was passed out of that commission as a resolution, and that is certainly in line with Senate Bill 193 with regard to 194. That was also part of the Global Warming Commission's resolution. So both of those pieces are supported not only by my organization, but both the subcommittee and the Natural Resource Committee of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. It was interesting to me. It's unfortunate that Senator Atkinson was not here to see the bicycle with two wheels, eight baskets, and no handlebars. And I think that what we're looking for in Oregon is some handlebars. We do have the Water Resources Commission, and the department does have co-equal goals that is in their organic statute. Those have not been met, and they're not on track to be met. And I think that this legislative body, and ideally with the governor, saying the plan is to achieve these co-equal goals, not talk about them, not just provide cover so we can do what we were doing before, but actually achieve these things. We have qualified support for both these bills. We do seek a proper stakeholder engagement. Under the direction of that co-equal achievement. We like that DEQ is involved. Certainly you have to have co-authors in DEQ and Water Resources. We think that the plan certainly could benefit from best available science and some more formal review from Fish and Wildlife, Department of State Lands, and others as appropriate. Certainly Professor Vance Borland's recommendations are good as well. But we are in a hurry to return resilience to our freshwater ecosystems. Not only are fish are not on track to be recovered. Time is up. Fish aren't on track. Water's not on track. Ag's running out of water.
That was planned for your testimony.
Yeah. Well, I've got 3 minutes of David's time.
Are you yielding your time?
Potentially.
The first disagreement, right?
There it is. I think where we're at, we're in a place where we do need to get our future lined out for us. And I think that with some direction from the chair in this committee, I think we can get all the needed details built into the plan that we need to. And we did have a written testimony passed.
Yeah, got it. Thank you very much. You get 2 minutes.
Great.
He stole one of yours.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Pills. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Water Trust as well as Oregon Trout. I'll try not to duplicate anything Joe said, except to, stress that we're about to celebrate the 100th birthday. And what I think that means is that the question before the committee today is how will we mark the next century of water management in Oregon? As best I can tell, Senate Bill 193 comes from a variety of sources, as everyone has mentioned, the H2O strategy, statewide water roundtables, as well as the Water Subcommittee of the Global Warming Commission. The pedigree of the bill is a little hard to follow, and I think there's a lesson to be learned from that, and that is when we talk about the process of coming up with this plan, the plan will only be as cohesive as the planning process that creates it. And our success at implementing the plan will only run as deep as the buy-in to the plan's goals and objectives. So with that in mind, the goal for the planning process should really be engaging stakeholders in pursuit of action over arguments and solutions over positions. I think we all can agree that there's a lot of diverse interests converging on the banks of Oregon's rivers. And the classic scenario when we all get in the same room is to dig in heels and fall back on well-rehearsed positions. But looking at the state of freshwater resources after a century of that same conversation, I think we can all agree there's a better way to do that. So what I suggest and what we suggest is that we focus on action. And I think the best way to focus on action and to get away from our traditional positions is to look around the room and look each other in the eye and admit that we can't all have everything we want out of an eventual plan and not let our traditional positions get in the way of achieving a significant plan in the end. I will reiterate again that the plan should be focused on the co-equal goals of the Water Resource Commission and the Department, which are, one, to restore and protect stream flows and watersheds for long-term sustainability of Oregon's ecosystems, economy, and quality of life, and two, directly address Oregon's supply needs. The key to achieving these goals is building resiliency and adaptability into eventual water management. I think I'll stop there to avoid any duplication. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you for coming here today and sharing your thoughts. I really appreciate it. And I did notice that you had, on both your written testimony, also comments on 194. We will do a brief public hearing on that right afterwards, and you can decide if you want to come up again or not.
Great.
Thanks. Okay, next, we just have a few people left. Katie Fast. Is Katie still in the room? John DeVoe, and Daniel Eisenbeis.
Hi, Katie. Hi, good evening. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau
it's
Federation.
Still afternoon, don't say evening.
Don't get us started.
Yeah.
Sorry. Just,
it's a sore point with my committee. So.
Understand how this committee sometimes has been running.
don't remind us.
Yeah.
back to Senate Bill 193. I had the honor of serving on the governor's H2O task force that developed this legislation, and the Farm Bureau is supportive, feel that there is a need for some long-term planning strategy, both on quality and quantity and bringing those entities together at the table. However, I have two things to say about this. One, I think you'll hear some comments about bringing Department of Fish and Wildlife to a higher elevated position equal to DEQ. Farm Bureau would oppose this addition. That was an area where there needed to be one lead agency, but the quantity or quality side needed to be brought out, and so DEQ was put in the higher role they are. But I think once you start adding additional agencies to a higher elevated role, I think there gets a question of where do you stop. And there was a lot of discussion around the table at the H2O negotiations about if we were to add ODF&W, should we also be adding economic development to bring those aspects of water supply and water needs to the table as well, or Department of Agriculture to a higher elevated position due to the use and needs of irrigated agriculture. So we support the bill as drafted. My other comment to the legislation would be it was drafted and put to a idea and concept at a time where I don't think the state's economic gloom and doom was to what it is right now. And so Farm Bureau does have concerns about moving the legislation forward with the dedicated funds and the FTE needed to do a good job on this plan at this time due to cuts that the agency may be seeing for the 09-11 biennium budget. So I would say our request is to maybe move the committee to Ways and Means for that discussion to happen there, but it might be a time in the state where we need to wait 2 years so we have the adequate funds to do a good job on this planning and not compromise other programs at the agency.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daniel Eisenbeis. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. In the interest of time, I will keep my remarks very brief. Like the Farm Bureau and some of the other stakeholders before you today, the League was involved in the H2O work group process that led to this proposal as well as others. And the League supports Senate Bill 193 as drafted for the reasons that I think you've heard today. It's clear that the state needs to develop a better integrated water resources strategy to meet our various needs in the decades to come. I do want to call out that the structure of this effort and how the bill is drafted was the result of a very deliberative process, and is, as Ms. Bast described, there was a very sort of conscious logic to making Water Resources Department the lead agency and calling out the Department of Environmental Quality to be consulted with, because those are the two agencies that have regulatory authority and responsibility for water supply and water quality in this state. The bill is very clear that roles shall be assigned to other state agencies, and we believe that that's the appropriate way to handle involving those other agencies. Like the Farm Bureau, the League of Oregon Cities has concerns that as this effort moves forward, adequate resources be provided to implement the development of this strategy. Our recommendation would be that the committee move this bill to Ways and Means so that discussion about funding can occur. The League's hope would be that the legislature takes the governor's recommendation for providing additional funding to DEQ and WRD in order to implement this policy. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and I'll be happy to address any questions.
Thank you, John.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is John DeVoe. I'm the executive director of Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch was founded in 1985, and we have hundreds of members across Oregon who care deeply about the condition of our rivers and balanced water policy in the state. I, too, served on the H2O Advisory Committee at the leisure of the governor, and I was involved in discussions about the origins of this bill. My friends have anticipated my testimony here today. If we are to have a truly integrated water strategy for Oregon, we must have a biological voice involved in this process. And as you could see from the presentations by DEQ and WRD today, there was very little discussion of biology, of fish, and those needs. If we're talking about a water future in Oregon, we need to have a biological voice in the effort. And to have an integrated strategy for the state, we believe that it's essential that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife be one of the three top-tier agencies, and that its commission have ratifying authority, and that it be also directed to adopt rules to implement a strategy. There's been some discussion about these two agencies having sole authority for water in the state. I think that's an error. ODF&W has authority over hydropower. It has authority over fist passage. It has authority involving transfers of water. It has authority involving new water rights that are issued in the state. In fact, it consults on most of those currently with the Water Resources Department. ODF&W has tremendous control over municipal extensions in the state right now. It participates in rural advisory committees, serves on legislative task forces, and it frankly has a great deal to do with water in this state. So if we're talking about a truly integrated strategy, we need to have a biological voice serving on this effort, and ODF&W needs to be that voice. I also share the concerns of my friends over devoting sufficient resources to doing this effort right. I'm not sure we can get a good job out of the current level of effort that is described in the governor's recommended budget. And if we're going to undertake this effort, we really need to have the resources to do a good job on it. We certainly appreciate the current coordination between agencies that we see, but as Senator Haas has pointed out, there really is no guarantee that future administrations will follow the same procedures we see today, and we feel that a strategy ought to be mandating that kind of coordination in the future. The final issue I'll raise is that the final section of the bill is drafted is a little bit unclear as to which agencies may submit legislative amendments or submit budget recommendations to help secure a long-term dedicated funding source to implement the water strategy. We believe that that section ought to be opened up so that any agency that has a need in this area is able to submit budget recommendations to secure its capacity to do what's needed in the area of water in Oregon. So thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you all. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. And last up, we have three folks. Then we're going to open up Senate Bill 194 and then take a quick testimony on that one. Richard Kosasan, Trey Carsedan, sorry, I'm losing my voice, and Anita Winkler. Richard, why don't you start?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Kosasan, Water for Life.
Go ahead, please. Your 3 minutes is quick ticking.
Water for Life, as constructed today, would oppose Senate Bill 193. Basically sets up a new strategy, and I think one should take a look at the existing strategies. I would agree with the previous speaker suggesting that we do have policies. and they're pretty well delineated. You have policies on minimum stream flows. You have policies on water storage facilities, water supply, formulation of a state water resources program, policies to be considered when formulating state water resources program. I don't believe that they are coordinated. So rather than set up a new program, it might be beneficial to go back and look at our existing policies, outline those policies, and see what works. In terms of the structure here, we have basically put Water Resources Department on equal footing with DEQ. And I think I would agree in part with John DeVoe. The programs of, quote, natural resource agencies should be integrated. Years ago, we had a strategic water management planning group in the state of Oregon, which basically represented natural resource agencies in an effort to get agency heads or their designees together to talk about water-related issues on a regular basis. Unfortunately, that met its demise, but I think that should be looked at as a consideration. In terms of the limited budget that we face today, we would again suggest taking a look at your existing policies, maintain the oversight by a single agency. If you don't, I think we have certain conflicts inherent with our existing structure. For example, in stream flows, we put DEQ in charge on an equal footing with Water Resources Department, but in terms of our in-stream flow programs, there's equal footing for DEQ, Fish and Wildlife, Parks and Recreation. We should take a look at that. In terms of the overall water policy for the state, the bill suggests that the strategy shall take effect when it is adopted by reference in rules promulgated by both the Water Resources Commission and the Environmental Quality Commission. We would suggest that a state policy, perhaps one that is somewhat more coordinated than the ones we have today, should be statutorily established as opposed to established by rule.
Okay, could you wrap up, please?
How's that? I've just wrapped up.
That's great. Thanks, Richard. Anita, why don't you go next?
Commissioner Dingfelder, members of the committee, Anita Winkler, I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress.
I was promoted. I'm actually a senator, but it's okay.
Did I say I'm? I apologize.
They get paid more.
They get paid more. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Promoted or demoted. I apologize.
It's okay, I've been called worse.
I get overtime after 5, too.
Yeah.
Okay, you want me to go 5 minutes instead of 3 to get you to overtime? We represent irrigation districts and other water delivery systems that serve agriculture around the state. I also served on the H2O Advisory Committee. It's kind of old home week here for all of us. And this was a concept that we worked very hard on as a group to come to some agreement. You'll notice I didn't use the word consensus because obviously we didn't have complete consensus on it. But we as an organization support the bill. We do remain concerned about the budget impact and the request for more funding at a time when, as was pointed out earlier, it's a department facing some significant impacts and potential cuts on their budget. But as a policy and setting a framework for the state to move forward, we think it's important. And we think this bill can stand on its own without the budget to carry forth the work with a great deal of stress on the department and a lot of commitment from other people to continue to work forward. I think that the effort to move forward is going to be there with or without this bill. And the bill provides a very good framework and a very good guidance to move forward. We do support the kind of co-equal relationship between DEQ and Water Resources Department in this effort. We would not support adding ODF&W or any of the other departments that we talked about at H2O and that you've heard discussed here. It's hard for me to imagine opening the door for one without opening the door for many others. And I think those are the two departments that are responsible for the regulation and the administration of the state's policies related to water and water quality.
Okay, thank you. Last but not least.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Trey Karskaden, and I live in Tualatin. I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association to voice our support of Senate Bill 193. In our view, now is the time to look ahead and face the challenges of our growing population and strained water infrastructure. Fish, wildlife, agriculture, industry, and communities all need water. We applaud the governor's initiative and the work of this committee to advance this discussion, which we believe is critical to our interests and the interests of this great state. Too often, these last few sessions, I found myself opposing various water measures that would have broadly benefited communities in the state because of the cost level to sensitive salmon, trout, and steelhead that our industry desperately depends on. Through those sessions, I've left this building feeling like I've done a disservice to good people in other parts of this state that need water as badly as we do. It's somewhat ironic, given Oregon's reputation as a habitually rainy state where Oregonians don't tan, they rust. But as you know, the challenges are growing, they're real, and they demand attention. The Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association is hopeful that Senate Bill 193 is the first step in several steps in creating an overreaching water plan and strategy that better serves all communities and leaves no Oregonian wanting for water. And thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thanks for your service to the state.
Great. Thank you all for being here today. Appreciate it. Any
thanks.
Quick questions? Okay. So with that, is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 193? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 193. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 194 and ask Phil Ward and Brenda Bateman from the Water Resources Department to come up and do a brief introduction, and then we have just a couple of panels of folks that have signed up. And we're going to go down to 2 minutes in testimony, so we can make sure we get everybody on before we adjourn. Welcome back.
So, Madam Chair, for the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. How do you want us to proceed here? We do have a brief PowerPoint that we could speed through.
Why don't
you
do
want us to do that?
Yep.
We will speed then. Water use measurement, Senate Bill 194, Madam Chair and members. Let's keep going here, Brenda.
We have a lot of the same people that want to testify, so I hate to ask them to come back another day.
I understand.
We're going to adopt their stuff, the ones that have already testified.
Right. When already testified, we'll just adopt them in the record.
So why is it important to measure water in the state? Obviously, our water resource is limited. We use measurement to be able to distribute and manage Oregon's water resource accurately, critical for active water management. So the Water Resources Commission actually adopted a strategic plan in 2000 for increasing the measurement we do of Oregon's water resources. It prioritizes the installation of measuring devices. The concept is major on the majors. In other words, get the guys measuring who are using the most water, diverting the most water, or having the most impact on a critical resource area. So we identified what we called something called significant diversions. These are diversions that have permit conditions that require a measuring device, or divert more than 5 CFS, or divert a high percentage of the flow of a stream. With ODF&W, we identified high priority watersheds, those with significant biological issues. And so the commission's plan uses those definitions, and it identified 2,200 significant diversions around the state in high-priority watersheds. This represents about 10% of all the overall diversions in those watersheds, but it accounts for about 50% of the water diverted in those watersheds. So you can see the three phases of implementation that this bill would anticipate. So really the phase prior to phase one has been the identification of the significant diversions and high priority watersheds. Now, the three phases that this bill would implement are articulated here. And we can go on, Brent, I think. So phase one, 200 significant diversions where they already have permit conditions and they're not in compliance with those conditions. Phase two, 150 additional significant diversions that don't have permit conditions currently, but that still are significant diversions and under by an order of the water master could be directed to measure. And then phase three would be finding the last 1,800. Again, these are folks that wouldn't have current permit conditions, and they would need to have measurement devices installed by 2012. So here's the difficult piece with this piece of legislation. Again, it was crafted as we worked through the governor's H2O initiative. Before the economic situation we're in today, there were resources anticipated to address the needs of this bill. These are what those resources would be today. So that's a difficulty relative to the bill today, because it does establish a hard date for us meeting the strategic plan, and that date is September 1, 2012. That could not be met with existing resources. These are other items related to the bill, 9-member advisory committee, and an update report to the interim legislative committee before November 1st, 2012.
Thank you for going through that quickly. And by the way, committee members, we'll make sure you get copies of this PowerPoint presentations. Before I take Senator Boquist's question, a couple of quick questions for you, Phil. One is, why, if this is already required, you already have this as part of your part of your plan for measuring on the majors, why do you see a need for all this additional FTE? And I don't understand if there's a requirement to measure already, why would the Water Resources Department have to install it? Why not the water right holder?
Madam Chair, excellent questions. So this strategy was adopted by the Commission without additional resources to undertake it. So the department has been moving forward utilizing existing resources. Mm-hmm. The first big task, as we noted, was to find all these diversions, identify them. That's been done. This last biennium, we've begun the implementation, actually touching those folks with permit conditions and not implementing the measurement ourselves, but ensuring that the landowner does.
Okay. So that was my question. Why, then, do you have, and if you could go back a slide or two, I think you have 5 FTEs in there. There you go, assistant water masters. So if as part of their permit requirements they're required to measure already, why is the state then paying for that?
Well, again, Madam Chair, the state would not be paying for the actual measuring device except as if there were matching funds available,
okay,
as noted there. But what the water masters would be doing is actually working with those landowners to get those devices in place. So, for example, if I send you a card in the mail that says get your measurement device in place by Wednesday, the likelihood of that being implemented and of folks knowing what they need to do in many cases without a personal touch from our staff is not very high.
Okay. So your bullet point under here, what Senate Bill 194 would do, says that it would require the department to install measuring devices on 2,200 significant diversions. So if
I'm sure that's a misnomer.
Okay.
So it would require measuring devices to be installed. So thank you for that.
Well, my point was that if part of your permit requirement is to do something, then I don't think the state should be paying the cost of that. Certainly, it is the cost of the state to provide oversight to make sure that's done properly, but not for the actual installation. I guess that was my point.
And so, Madam Chair, I believe, and Brenda can correct me if I'm wrong, but where we've ordered these, where it's no longer a voluntary installation, I believe we have statute that would prohibit us from providing funds to do that. Is that correct?
Okay. And then my second question was, do we need a new advisory committee? I mean, why not just report to the commission?
Madam Chair, that would be acceptable to us.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Follow up on your question, mm-hmm. Madam Chair. Phil, it's $1.2 million to implement inside your department. It's $100,000 in cost sharing. Do you have the economic impact or the value of the other portion of the cost sharing? We're going to put in 2,200 of these. I think you... about 400 of them, I think, you have authority to. 1,800 people are going to get told, put in the device. What's the total cost of the 2,200 devices?
Madam Chair, Senator, don't have that off the top of my head. We can bring that back to you, but there would be definitely a landowner cost. Generally, we anticipate with these kind of funds about a 50% cost share.
Okay.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
So in theory, you're saying these 2,200 devices might cost about $200,000.
In theory, but that may be low, Madam Chair, Senator.
Thank you. I would like follow-up later, Madam Chair. Thank you.
That.
Do that.
Any other questions?
One question, if you can go to the last slide that had questions. We like to travel and see different places. Can you tell me what that waterfall is?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's Tocotee Falls.
Thank you.
You would know that.
And whose district
north
is that
Umpqua
in?
River, on the North Umpqua River.
Yep. Okay.
Are
thank
we measuring
you.
That one now?
Just measuring.
Yeah, I hope there's a... No. That's not a diversion, is it? Okay, thank you.
I thought Senator Porzanski did provide a diversion.
Yeah.
Welcome
okay, we have some
like
folks... who signed up. I know some of you already come up, so it's up to you if you want to come up again. Janet Newman, I know you had a couple of additions you wanted to add, and I know that you came here specifically, so I'll ask you to come up. I'm also going to call up Peggy Brown and, let's see, who else? Tracy Liske. And you have 2 minutes because we're pressed for time here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Once again, I'm Janet Newman, for the record. I will try to make this very quick. On Senate Bill 194, I really appreciate Water Resources Department's extensive work on their strategic measurement plan. What is most striking, though, when you look through that 100-page document is all the gaps in measurement, both in stream flow and on diversions. And how can we manage what we don't measure? We always measure what's important. Water resources are incredibly important. And my concern, I'm in favor of this bill. My concern is that it doesn't go far enough, fast enough, because we should be moving towards universal measurement. And I know that's a hugely controversial issue, and it can be very expensive. But, you know, I pay for my water out of my tap, depending on how much I use. We do that in all other areas of our economy, and there's some incredible resistance when it comes to water. And usually it's about who's going to pay for it and what it's going to mean in terms of existing water use. But the questions that were directed to the Water Resource Department just in previous testimony are very important to me, which is if you've got a requirement already and you're not measuring, you're out of compliance with your water right, and we ought to be enforcing those. And I'll close with just a quick little picture here. A few years ago, I wrote a law review article on waste and inefficiency and efficiency in Western water use. And I said, suppose an extraterrestrial or UFO lands in the Western United States and comes upon an irrigator flood irrigating a field. And the irrigator says, extraterrestrial says, what's your most important resource around here? It looks pretty dry. And they say, well, water is probably our most important resource. Well, you must have some pretty good technology for keeping track of it and measuring it. And the farmer says, you're looking at it. It's a ditch and an unmeasured diversion device. That's insane. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peggy Brown. I'm Baker County Farm Bureau President. I'm also the chairperson for Oregon Farm Bureau Water Advisory Committee. And what I do for a living, though, is I'm a consultant in the Powder Basin, which encompasses Baker County and a little bit of Union County. So in that, it has allowed me to see a lot of the water conservation projects and water rights projects that go through our county. And so I'm here to tell you from experience that water measurement is being implemented. It's being implemented on both a mandatory and I'll do it on my own scale. We work very closely with the water master and the deputies in our basin, and it's always encouraged to put in measurement devices, and it's rare that when it's encouraged and not mandated with a very heavy hand, especially when there's some cost share available, that people want to do the right thing and they want to start measuring because it does better help them manage their resource. So the bottom line that I'm trying to get across to you is it is being accomplished. My second point is something that everybody has already said in a couple of other, your previous testimony, is that there's no money to fund this right now, either the Water Use Advisory Committee or the implementation of these hard and fast deadlines. That number, $1.3 million, is a lot of money, and I'm sure Water Resources and everybody else can use whatever they have right now just to keep their staff intact. My next point is, I think if we stepped back and looked at Water Resources Department and how they're efficiently managing what they have right now, they're doing an excellent job. It used to take at least 4 years to get a water right transfer through the department, and now they're down to less than 2 years. And, you know, they still have a little ways to go because that still is hard for people on the ground to manage even a two-year transfer. It's a bit ridiculous, but we're making headway. So let's keep them intact. That's not extra, add an extra burden that would be unfunded. And just to reiterate my points, water measurement is steadily being implemented, and I really appreciate the time and consideration to this matter.
Thank you for coming here today.
My name is Tracy Liske. I'm First Vice President of Oregon Farm Bureau and a farmer in Klamath Falls, where water is a good issue. You know, it has been stated, Oregon Water Resource Department is going to have 20 to 30 positions proposed to be cut from them, so money is a big issue on this thing. But the one address of this bill that I want to address is the committees. And the committee, if you're going to put a committee, you've got to fund it. Again, we're with water. A unfunded committee, all it has is some good ideas. It puts additional work on the staff because there's no staff to help the committee. Volunteers can do a good job, but they've got jobs themselves, especially if you put agriculture people on that committee, and that's what has to be on this committee because agriculture is a huge part of the water that you want measured. And the representation has to be with agriculture. And they have a job. They have a full-time job that works more hours than they can put in anyway. So if you're going to make a committee, make sure it's funded. And again, without any money, it's kind of ridiculous to get this done. And the timelines on this whole bill are just unrealistic to get done with the amount of money and the amount of staff that we have available to the Water Resource Department. And they are doing a very good job of the permits, water resources. All my new diversions and new irrigation systems all have water meters on them and stuff. It is getting done, and most of the time shows that I've used a lot less than most people think we use. And so, you know, the benefit to the public is there's some good benefit out there, but it isn't going to save. It isn't a savior factor. I mean, we use water very efficiently in agriculture. It isn't one of those issues that we just throw away and run down the ditch because we like to see it go by. It's hard work. It's hard things to do. It's money. We pump it. We pay for that pumping. And so conservation is very important in agriculture, and that's what we like to do.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you very much for coming here today. And we have one last panel. It's going to be very quick. Richard Costasan. Richard, come up, please. If you want to speak, you can pass if you want. You've got 2 minutes. Jim Welsh and John DeVoe. I'm going to have one of you speak. I know you have two of you signed up, but we're out of time. Okay, Jim, why don't you get started?
Chair Dingfeld and committee members, Jim Welsh.
Have a mutiny otherwise.
Oregon Cattlemen Association, and a number of the concerns that we have about this legislation have already been shared with you. And all our questions here do have a lot to do with the cost to the department. And we don't believe at this time that they probably have the money to push forward with this unless the legislature sees it as a priority to get this funded. There's a program since in 542-600 and that was amended last time in 1985, and if it was a legislative priority, it would have been done by now. And so, you know, all our questions just continue to ask, how is this going to happen? Where will the funds come from to implement this program at this time? The Oregon Cattlemen Association, after review of state water statute, determines that this bill is not necessary. There are present statutory provisions for strategic measurement to occur when needed per individual site, multiple sites, or basin by basin, and this approach is more attainable financially than a new statewide program. Furthermore, it is evident from past legislative history and present fiscal restraints that funding the new strategic measurement plan will be difficult, if not impossible. And so we just don't think this bill is necessary.
Okay, thank you. Richard, why don't you go next? We're under 2 minutes, so you get the star.
Madam Chair, Richard Costasan, Water for Life. Basically concurring with the previous comments in terms of the need for the legislation. If one were to take a look at the department's existing authority to require measurement. It's fairly broad, it's fairly precise, and it's been around for years. 536.099, all governmental entities are required to measure and report their use. 537.211, grants the department authority to require measurement as a condition of issuing a new permit, which is, I think, what the chair referenced shortly before. 537.545, authority to the department to even measure exempt uses, which has been a point of contention in recent years. 540.310, 540.320, 540.435, and I think I missed a couple. But the bottom line issue is, does the department maintain the tools today to direct people to measure their water use? And in many circumstances, I would argue that that is a very strong, good, positive endeavor, and the answer is yes. But in terms of setting up a new structure, requiring resources with the limited dollars that we have today, I think that perhaps this should be put on the table for a while.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask just one of you to go. Okay. In the essence of time.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, John DeVoe with Water Watch. The department's strategy has been around for almost a decade. In 2000, the Water Resources Commission approved this strategy, and since then we've had, frankly, little movement on measurement under the strategy, as you saw through some of the PowerPoint slides. We have a situation where people with permit conditions who are required to measure have not measured, and it would seem to me that that's not a huge fiscal impact to simply send a letter saying you're out of compliance with your permit, and if you don't get into compliance, we're going to start cancellation proceedings. As to Senate Bill 194, we have issues with how the bill is drafted. It doesn't make a lot of sense the way it is currently drafted. Section 1 refers to the plan in Section 2, which is never described. And so we have offered amendments to clarify what the plan actually is and what ought to be done. Our suggestion here to address the fiscal situation is, instead of having a hard deadline for achievement of this implementation of measurement, we would have a iterative reporting back to the legislature over time on the progress that's being made under the strategy. And that, in our belief, that would take away a lot of the fiscal impact with this bill. So that's our proposal. We believe that it's essential that as Oregon moves into a situation where we have growth, where we have climate change, you know, what gets measured gets managed. And until we measure water in the state, and we currently don't measure more than half the water that's diverted in this state, according to the department, we need to have a strategy to get there. So our proposal is, make clear that the department will implement the strategy as it was presented to the commission back in 2000. Use that strategy. Second, require the reporting of the measured water use under that strategy. Third, require a report to the legislature each session until the strategy is fully implemented on the details of what's happening with implementation. And four, codify the Water Resources Department's existing practice of requiring measurement and reporting of new surface water, groundwater, and reservoir rights. We believe these are modest steps to take. And we'll start us on the path towards better management of this resource, which is critical for the state and its future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Okay. Anybody else would like to testify in Senate Bill 194? Okay. Thank you for all your input on these bills, and obviously these are two bills that we'll be hearing more about. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 194 and close the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. Thank you again, committee members, for your patience.